So you're saying with Hilton Honors, I can use points for a free night stay anywhere?
Anywhere.
What about fancy places like the Canopy in Paris?
Yeah, Hilton Honors, baby.
Or relaxing sanctuaries like the Conrad in Tulum?
Hilton Honors, baby.
Ooh, what about the 5-star Waldorf Astoria in the Maldives?
Are you gonna do this for all 9,000 properties?
When you want points that can take you anywhere, anytime, it matters where you stay. Hilton, for the stay. Book your spring break now.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. Stop waiting around for the perfect candidate. Instead, use Indeed-sponsored jobs to find the right people with the right skills fast. It's a simple way to make sure your listing is the first candidate see. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs have 4 times more applicants than non-sponsored jobs. So go build your dream team today with Indeed. Get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Good things come in fours, like ukulele strings, boy band members, and PayPal Pay in 4. No fees, no interest, no impact on your credit score. Just the flexibility to pay the way that works for you. Strum it, hum it, pay it in 4. Tap the banner to learn more. Subject to approval. Learn more at paypal.com/payin4. PayPal Inc. NMLS 910457.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Late Antiquity, presented by Ancient Jew Review. I'm Mike Mutia, and today we're talking with Michael Sadlow about An Enchanted World, the Shared Religious Landscape of Late Antiquity. The philosopher Charles Taylor argued that we live in a disenchanted world. Taylor develops this from Max Weber, yes, but Taylor's point is it's not that nobody believes in God anymore. I mean, most people still do. His point is that belief has become an option. People can pray or not. They can go to synagogue or not. They can live based on a divinely inspired code or by human rights or by national laws or just by that little voice in their head. Now, when exactly that happened is hard to say, but Taylor provides this image of a buffered self, the opposite of a porous one, kind of subject to demons and spirits and magic. And that kind of buffered self, it's one that seems, I don't know, most obvious to at least the kind of people who are going to read his book. And maybe this is a philosophical development, maybe this is an economic or a capitalist one, maybe it's a technological one, but whatever it is, that kind of buffering, that boundedness is something different from the pre-modern world. And it's so different that it's sometimes hard for modern readers to really imagine life before the bumpers between heaven and earth kept us rolling through life. Michael Sadlow has attempted to show that before to Taylor's after, and he shows how this world can teach all of us, even the Taylorites among us, something new and fresh. The world of late antiquity, he argues, was an enchanted world, a world where everyday life was lived with the gods. The gods were as much a fact of life as parents and kids and fires and chairs. And people related differently to gods than they did to their chairs, but they did relate to them. People would have been considered kind of stupid or at least odd not to. And one mistake we can make when we think about this enchanted world is to overlabel groups, to get really invested in religious identity, especially. Late antiquity, as historians rightly say, is a time when Christianity and Judaism, they kind of take the shape that is still recognizable today. But these abstract groups, they were, and they remain to this day, kind of fuzzy creations of intellectual elites. The boundary lines and the identities, they weren't always so clear to people on the ground. And his identities kind of, they flare up. They become important at different times of the day or the month or in different places and in different company. Jews thought of themselves primarily through their ethnic, not religious identity. The Greeks and Romans, the people that Christians kind of despairingly called pagans, they had their own nuanced, layered understandings of identity. Christians, like, sometimes they cared a lot about if or how someone was a Christian, and sometimes they just wanted to trade with whoever had the best price of cabbage. Michael Sadlow argues that the intellectual elites, in a sense then, they created these identities, that the bishops and rabbis and Roman writers, they wanted to sharpen those fuzzy boundaries. They wanted to make them matter more often in more places and for more people. But because it's their literary works that survive, we can kind of too easily mistake their desires for the realities that we're trying to narrate. And so when we divide the people into groups, we can just all too easily forget the shared enchanted world that they all occupied. People in antiquity, of course, did divvy up the world, but most kind of shared a lot of background assumptions. And it's often easier to see the divisions. And that means that the real task for a modern historian is to put together lots of pieces of fragmentary evidence to try to see those shared backgrounds. Let me try to give an example, just to clarify a little bit. Archaeologists, they've discovered like thousands of little prayer fragments. These are like little pieces of silver. They kind of look like crumpled up tin foil. Longtime listeners might remember an episode with Laura Nasrallah where we discussed these. But these kind of crumpled up prayer fragments, they give us a kind of insight into the daily prayers of late ancient people. And the kind of remarkable thing about them is that when we look at them, it's almost impossible to tell if somebody is Christian or Jewish or Greek or Roman or Manichae or any of the other religious identities we might pin on them. Everybody wanted their kids to heal. Everybody wanted their lovers to love them. Everybody wanted businesses to thrive and money to last. What we really learn, though, from these prayer fragments is that so, so many people prayed. Michael Sattlow's An Enchanted World reconstructs this shared religious or spiritual landscape, as he calls it. The book tells the story of late antiquity, not as the rise of this or that religion, not like institutions or laws or canons or leaders, but as the story of everyday interactions with the invisible world. Most people weren't monks or rabbis or priests, but nearly everybody cultivated relationships with things unseen. So the point isn't that there was like a popular religion lurking under the official one. You probably don't need a book to know that. The goal is to understand how people between the 3rd and 7th centuries in and around the Roman Empire, sometimes in Persia, sometimes in the western regions of what was the Roman Empire, maintained those relationships between heaven and earth. Michael Sattlow is professor of Judaic and religious studies at Brown University. We're lucky to have him with us today. Michael, hi. Thank you for being here. Can you introduce yourself? Who are you and how'd you come to write this book?
Well, thank you for having me and thank you for that wonderful summary. This book has been a long time in the making. I began as a social historian, and really that's always what's fascinated me is getting a deep a social historian, not in a structuralist way or a Marxist way, but in really trying to figure out who people are and to visit their world and to try to understand how it's the same and how it's different, especially from our own. So when I began my career, I was interested in issues of sexuality, and that was actually supposed to be the first chapter of my dissertation, which then became the second book, which is on marriage. Thinking about the family. and that evolved into, this kind of wider interest in how it is that people related to these divine beings, which were so important to their world. And that took a long time. And it was actually, I wrote another book in the middle of this because I got so stuck in this book. And here's the problem. And I think this gets to the heart of the enchantment. What we call religion, these interactions with divine beings, is so entangled in the everyday life of people that it is really almost impossible to rip out and to disentangle and to look at separately. So if you're going to talk about it, you kind of have to talk about everything. And you can't talk about everything because that's not a book. Right. That's the whole field. So I kind of got stuck in there and started to think a little bit in the middle about issues of textuality. Mm-hmm. I wrote this other book, How the Bible Became Holy, and then I was able to come back to it. And during the COVID year, the horrible year in which most of us were Zoom teaching, which I actually dislike intensely, I was on leave, so I didn't have to. And so instead, I really sat down that year and thought I would, just kind of crack this nut and figure out some way to tell the story that I wanted to tell and to really to bring people into this world that I've kind of been inhabiting for a decade.
Yeah. And like one of the things, one of the ways that we try to break that, this religion's about everything thing down into smaller pieces is this idea of identity, which is still huge. But you think this is a pretty unhelpful way to try to, compress the huge issue. It's a common way that we talk about late antiquity. But what is it supposed to help us see? And then what does it actually obscure when we talk about identity?
So I think this is really an interesting phenomenon in the scholarship. And the scholarship has been, this is decades old already. And I think it's probably connected to issues in our own, especially American culture, which is that identity matters. Identity is important. And there's a flood of scholarship, which was certainly participated, in which you talk about identity formation How is it that different kinds of identities are formed? How are these different kinds of barriers and slots created? Strategies of formation? But I've begun to think over the last several years that it's not totally helpful. It is not unimportant. People do have identities and they activate their identities. But the identities, they are activated, particular identities in particular contexts. And also, they're very subjective, right? I can think of my identity in one way and you can think of it as something entirely differently. And my family is like totally annoyed at everybody's way of looking at my identity. So I mean, these things happen, they become very complicated. And by focusing on the identity, I think in a sense, we're playing the game of the identity formers. Mm. Now, there's a natural reason we do that because they're the ones who mainly left the texts, as you pointed out in the summary. Yeah. But really what I wanted to do was to push back against that and to say, let's look at the less differentiated landscapes and contexts in which people operated, which I think was pretty common. You know, when I go shopping, when I go through a lot of my normal everyday life, I don't at least consciously activate many of the identities that are ascribed to me and that I sometimes activate on my own. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think that's so different from antiquity. And it's really kind of trying to drill into that and lean into that notion that I talk about the identities in a chapter, but then I largely try to discard them and try to say, well, okay, these are people living in a less differentiated world.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading a lot of the book as saying, and we talk a lot about what it's like when the identities flare up. And I mean, and that's great, but sometimes it's hard to remember like what it's like what they're flaring up from, like what they're jumping out of. And you got to actually understand that to understand the flaring in the first place. You know, you're skeptical of identity, but the book it does care about how people were labeled and governed, right? So it's not like it doesn't matter at all, but it's kind of about where and how it matters. And in Christianity, you know, as a religion, that kind of gets pushed aside, but as an ethnicity or as a product of ethnic thinking, it is still helpful. Or, you know, Judaism as a religion might not make a lot of sense, but there are laws requiring Jews to pay specific taxes or prohibiting marriages between Christians and Jews. And that requires some way of telling, you know, who's Christian, who's Jewish. I think I have that right. And then you get kind of really interested in this category of what you call like voluntary associations. Can you tell us a little bit about what voluntary associations help us understand about identities and how they matter?
Well, these were very common, especially in the Greek and Roman worlds. And they were primarily, they were almost semi-legal, semi-corporatized sometimes. Sometimes they were more informal. But they were ways in which people created communities among themselves, primarily for the function of helping each other after death, burying each other, creating this kind of support group and funding, you know, but they would also come together for a banquet every once in a while and eat together and so on. So these voluntary formations, you know, voluntary associations, they become really a kind of one of the major ways in which people could identify as, let's say, a devotee of the particular divinity or angel or archangel or whatever, you know, whatever figure this is. So they would, you know, could come together around that figure. I think with Jews, you have a long tradition of ethnic identity. Mm-hmm. So there definitely is this notion in the air of ethnicity. With Christians, as you point out, it is more complicated, because Christians in some formations, I'm sure, did not want to see themselves as an ethnicity. And yet they often, as we have much very great scholarship on this, talk about kind of the way they thought ethnically about being a Christian. And this is actually, this is one of these issues that I think is true to the modern day. Christians and Jews, the way they think about their identity as well as individuals, rather than kind of as they're told institutionally. So the voluntary association might be a synagogue. Let's imagine this for a second, right? If you have a synagogue, is anyone policing who comes in and out of the synagogue? Is anyone policing who gives money in? I mean, where's the identity? In that case, I might identify myself as a Jew because I enter the synagogue and I participate in the affairs of the synagogue and I give money for the synagogue. Am I? Well, from a legal perspective, maybe I don't want to be a Jew because that might give me extra taxes. And maybe I'm not, you know, somebody down the street maybe doesn't think of me as a Jew because I also think that that Jesus guy is maybe kind of cool too. So that's where things, you know, get all fuzzy. But the voluntary associations, I think, are ways, you know, in which people, like a bowling club, they make communities here. And you mm-hmm. find them around, obviously, you find churches that are dedicated to particular saints. And that's, a carryover of this kind of thinking.
Hmm. Yeah. Like in the same way you can be a baker or something like that. And you got your baker buddies. When you start thinking about religion, not as its own kind of group, but it's like one of many different kinds of groups that people kind of, you know, they find some kind of core that they rally around. I mean, it's a more helpful way sometimes to understand kind of how rituals bring together a group. The next chapter, it talks about, the idea of kind of projection, like in religious studies, we talk about people projecting their own ideas into the heavens a lot. That happens all the time for everybody. But I think in late antiquity, it's like easy to get Protestant about this and to think when we say heaven and earth, what we mean is like God and individual. And the chapter really lays out this like really messy layer of bureaucracy that would go into governing the Roman and Sasanian empires. Like by the fourth century, you have this huge rise in bureaucracy in the empire. And so there was an emperor, yes, but like the average person never sees the emperor, right? Like they deal with some kind of intermediary, people with discrete jobs and limited autonomy. And, you know, they could be lenient or strict, but, you know, none of those intermediaries get to make the rules, right? And you say that's actually how the invisible world works too, that nobody gets to see God and live. But you write that heaven was a busy, complicated place for Romans, Greeks, Jews, Christians, and others. So, like, of course, you know, you have intellectuals writing, you know, books about sacred hierarchies. But on the ground, like, how do people navigate these systems? Maybe God at the top is easy to imagine, but can you tell us about, I'm going for an example here, like about Judaism and angels? Like, how does understanding the kind of rise of bureaucracy and the bureaucracy of heaven help us think about these angels?
Yeah, so I think to even kind of take a broader view, I would say we're talking about invisible beings. So you have this, it's not, as you say, we have this notion that, well, maybe there's something kind of between heaven and earth, that they're actually kind of different, right? There's a barrier there. And I think in most people's mind, there maybe kind of is, certainly to kind of the supreme God. And that could be Jupiter. It could be the Trinity. It could be, you know, the Adonai, the God of the Jews. But actually, there are all these beings like walking around with us. I mean, I think they're here. That's the enchantment here. Yeah. And you have to try to make sense of them only for a particular context. And that's like knowing who to call on for what. You want to have good relationships with as many of these beings as you can, because someday, you know, you're going to need them. You're going to need them for your crops. You're going to need them to protect you. You're going to need them to protect yourself from illness. And some of them you just want to keep really far away from you, right? So you're really busy with this kind of protective work as well. So you might start thinking, when you start thinking like that, right, you think, well, okay, there are certain beings that, as you mentioned, like the emperor, I mean, they're really powerful, important beings. And let's say I'm having a problem with something relatively minor, right? I have an itch that I want cured. And if I take that up to the emperor, that's dangerous. That's probably not wise, because the emperor's not going to blow me off here and maybe actually kill me. So I'm going to try to find somebody, some being further down what I think is imagined as a hierarchy, who's a little more approachable. That might be the spirit of my dead father. Or it might be something a little bit that I have in my head as maybe an angel. Now, if we think of it, there is abundant evidence that Jews turned to angels in late antiquity, as did everybody, for all kinds of things. So that's how they would have functioned. You know? So it's a little bit more than the spirit of a person or a ghost or however we want to call it. They have all these different names for these things in antiquity. And it was muddled. I don't think, you know, again, as the intellectuals are creating all these, like, well, let's chart out really the heavens, the relationship between all of these things. Did people care? I mean, even this really important distinction made by theologians of Christ and the Trinity and the relationship between these persons of the Godhead. It's like, who cared? Did people care? Some people certainly cared. But for many people, maybe it's not so relevant. You know, you will turn to Jesus for this, that, or the other thing and not actually really care about whether it was born of the same substance or created and generated and all these different terms that rack the minds of some of these theologians.
Yeah, like and people might care a lot about, you know, if the other person doesn't subscribe to the same or ascribe to the same creed as you do, but you might not actually understand it, right? Like, you know, nobody understands the Trinity, but people care a lot if they disagree about the Trinity. And so like exactly how that works can be tricky for sure. You make this distinction or that you trace out this distinction between angels and spirits. And you write that the spirits don't so much act in the world the way a saint might, but they provide a shadow window into the netherworld. Can you tell us about these spirits and like how were people invoking them? Why were they important to people?
So, I mean, spirits would associate with especially dead relatives. Yeah. The issue of piety to dead relatives is an important shared feature of, I think, most people in late antiquity, and you could argue much further outside of late antiquity and outside of the Mediterranean and Near Eastern world, too. Mm-hmm. And there's the idea that the spirit of a deceased family member would kind of hover around, and they could be useful, especially because, well, they care about you. There's a kind of inverse relationship. The more a being cares about you, the less power they have, right? So, you know, you can turn to the spirit, but the spirit doesn't have as much power. And there's a certain logic to this, right? Because this is kind of how it works in the world.
Sure. Yeah.
The CEO is not going to care so much about me, but has all the power.
Yeah.
So in that way, these spirits do have some knowledge of the future. They were ascribed this kind of prognosticating skill. So maybe you could go to it, you can get a little bit of knowledge out of it if you're careful, or at least because you think they have that, maybe they can look over you for a bit. But their agency is more limited. So when you get into these beings with more agency, again, do you call them angels? Maybe, maybe not. There's a certain kind of continuum here. They may have, greater juice in the world.
Yeah.
No me lo esperaba. TikTok tiene más short dramas de los que puedo terminar. Cada episodio te deja queriendo el siguiente. Descarga TikTok ahora y pruébalo.
TaxAct knows filing taxes can be confusing, so we have live experts on hand who can help answer any questions you may have. Questions like, can I claim my SUV as my home office if I answer work emails in my car? If I adopted 12 dogs this year, can I list them as dependents? And am I doing this right, or am I doing this very, very wrong? Our experts have the answers to those questions and many others. TaxAct. Let's get them over with.
No one goes to Hank's for spreadsheets. They go for a darn good pizza. Lately, though, the shop's been quiet. So Hank decides to bring back the $1 slice. He asks Copilot in Microsoft Excel to look at his sales and costs and help him see if he can afford it. Copilot shows Hank where the money's going and which little extras make the dollar slice work. Now Hank's has a line out the door. Hank makes the pizza, Copilot handles the spreadsheets. Learn more at m365copilot.com/work.
So people understand kind of the everyday workings of invisible bureaucracies. I don't know, like they understand that about as well as people today understand the workings of our government, right? Like, you know, some people understand a lot, some people barely get it at all. Then there's like, I don't know, activists today or intellectuals in late antiquity that do spend a lot of time trying to explain the invisible forces governing people's lives. And I don't know, like this is what we would usually call theology or philosophy. But you want to kind of recontextualize that work, that the kind of intellectual part of an enchanted world, I don't know, it works a little differently than like what a theologian does today. How does this kind of enchanted world change the way we think about Augustine or Plotinus, kind of what they were doing?
Well, I think if we think about it as organizing the world in which they see around themselves, right? So they are not, it's not fully a kind of intellectual or philosophical pursuit. And this has to do also with some of the methodology of the book, which is complicated because it's very hard to get down to the level of, you know, where they don't have texts in the same way. But you see what I think are clear examples of people taking intellectuals, looking at things that people are doing, understanding they're born in the same world, they live in the same world, they are among the people in that way, but then trying to organize it into some systematic way and to control it, to make it make not just sense, but sometimes when these people have positions of authority, they're trying to use this to further their authority. So Peter Brown has a nice example of this that he talks about with the bishop's appropriation of alms. Well, don't give alms to poor people, give alms to us, and we'll give to poor people. And that, of course, has certain real power implications for the bishops and the control. So, let me just stop there.
Yeah. And like the kind of the work of the intellectual, I don't know, like that's kind of how Roman Williams describes the work of theology, like saying like what a theologian is supposed to be doing is like watching the way people organize their religious lives and then kind of like explaining it to them, like breaking it down piece by piece. And I think that's kind of what Augustine or Plotinus, that's what you see them doing. It's just that like they're also like building up, I mean, Augustine more than Plotinus, I think, is like building up an institution behind that, right? In a way that, I don't know, maybe today, like that part is just either obvious or isn't, I don't know, there's not the kind of, I don't know, the role of the theologian is just so much smaller today than, you know, for someone like Augustine, who you know, was a major player in his world, that maybe that's part of the difference there, too. People end up talking about these invisible forces a lot. But you talk about the kind of how the rituals and special objects are like what really make them real. And you talk a lot about this idea of contagious holiness. Can you talk about contagion and what that is, kind of how it works?
Yeah, you would think, and this becomes a theological problem for the theologians and the intellectuals. It's like, well, if does the spirit have a body? If so, is that body in a particular place? Is there more holiness in one place or another place? If you have, I mean, this is a kind of, this becomes a very important and famous debate among Jews later on, right? If you have a God that's everywhere, right? Why, what's the deal with the temple? Is there something special about that? Is there something special about the Kotel, the Western Wall? Is there more God there? Is there more holiness? And I think people generally, they're attracted to this idea that in fact there are objects and people and places that are holier, or there's more divine energy there than others. Now, once you have contact with that, though, and there are all these really, again, very interesting strategies of sometimes keeping people at a distance from that which has the most holiness. Mm. This is the standard architectural structure of a temple or a church or a synagogue or the the thing that kind of focuses the holiness is somewhere in the back, somewhere walled off. There's a nave, there's a niche, whatever it happens to be, to keep people a little bit far from it, and I think to emphasize its holiness. But that doesn't mean people don't want to touch it. Mm-hmm. And they come close and they touch mm-hmm. it, and there's are they whether it's a saint's garment or a bone for, you know, in a Christian tradition. So you certainly have this notion of I think, you know, contagion. Right? You want a little piece of the text with you, or there's something that is going to bring with it a little bit of that holiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell us about Torah scrolls and like how contagion works with them?
There's a very interesting conversations or discussions that the rabbis have about the sanctity of Torah scrolls and trying to kind of keep them, in a sense, non-contagious. You don't want to touch them. They're so contagious, you don't touch them. I think people were probably touching them. So there was Stephen Fine argued that it's really the Torah scroll that makes a synagogue holy for the rabbis. So you take the Torah scroll out of the synagogue, and now it's just a building. Even the rabbis weren't so comfortable with that idea. I think on the one hand, they kind of said, sure, yes. But on the other hand, it's like, well, what if you just buy a kind of decommissioned synagogue, a synagogue which has been totally emptied of all of its sacred texts, and make it into a latrine? They're not so comfortable with that. And I think they're reflecting this kind of general wider discomfort that there's still something special about that space. And sure, you can kind of sell, but you shouldn't really make it a latrine or a brothel or anything, you know, that's too yucky.
Yeah. 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 There's like some kind of like sacred remnant or residue or something like you, I don't know, it just feels icky. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, so the book wants us to think a little bit less about intellectuals describing identities and more about symbols, myths, and rituals that help maintain relationships. But people still do have leaders, or maybe better, you call them technicians, right? Have people who mediate between heaven and earth. Heidi Wendt, former Brown student, I think, described this as a world full of freelance ritual experts. And there's like all kinds of people doing this work. Like we've got aristocrats and senators who are also priests. There's dream interpreters and astrologers and necromancers and holy people and ascetics. And then you have this kind of final catch-all category that includes elders. That includes like Greek titles that we usually translate as priests. Can you tell us like how does differentiating these social roles help us understand the world better? Maybe we'll start with that. Like there's all these roles, like, and people wanted to distinguish them in some way. Like why do they want to distinguish them? How does that help us understand enchantment?
Well, I think just as you have to know the right being to go to for a particular thing, so too you have to know how to approach that being. That's where you may need some help. So you can approach the normal way of creating a social relationship, be it with one of these invisible beings or with a human being, is through a gift exchange. So that's what sacrifice ultimately is. And there are all these different forms of sacrifice and these forms of gift exchange, but it's not so easy always to give a gift to an invisible being. You're not quite sure where to put it. You don't quite know how to address it. So that being gets it. So you do have, I would shy away from leaders because we have a different notion generally of like what a leader is. Like you go to somebody for guidance, so that person is somehow proactive. And I think that probably misleads us in this context. Instead, I want to make a gift to a god or to an angel or something, and I have to go to the right person to do that. And that might be, you know, what would be a Roman priest or something. The language here gets complicated in the original text because the Roman priest is different than a Christian priest, and we're using different terms often. But, you know, there's some overlap here and there. So you have to find the right person. And that, yes, sometimes that's going to be a priest who has a role in a temple, and that's kind of formal, and they actually will put that on their inscriptions when they die, the priest of this or the so on. But often it's somebody hawking their wares in the agora. where, you know, you go up to the person and you say, I need an amulet or a scribe, or it might be somebody who is taking care of the local house church in some way. And they get this title, this presbyter title, which is it's so vague and complicated that it's hard to know. But again, but the, you know, when you get into the legal authorities, they try to define what this means because it comes with a tax break. So it becomes very important to define some of these roles in time. So you just have to know, kind of depends what you're doing, because that you don't usually don't know. You don't know how to inscribe the bowl or the, you know, little amulet to get to the goal that you want to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I'm trying to understand the category too. Like so we've got all these different kind of technicians, I guess. Like what is an elder doing that is similar to what a dream interpreter is doing? Like they're both mediating between heaven and earth, I think. But I found this like a helpful way to kind of think about like this, you know, agora of spiritual leaders or kind of like all these different spiritual entrepreneurs. But can you tell us like the what are the goals of this book is to get us to think less about identity and more about that kind of shared landscape. So can you tell us about the kind of shared landscape that keeps elder and dream interpreter like in the same field?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much they're actually in the same field, because that's very different. You know, if you're going to go to a basically you would go more to the dream interpreter, right? The elder or the presbyter or the priest or however you want to define this term. This is much more of a catch-all category of unclear technical skills. Dream interpreter has very clear technical skills. And, you know, you want to find that person. And they actually, there's a whole business of dream interpretation in antiquity. Mm-hmm. They have their own manuals. And you find the dream interpreter. Now, here's the identity thing. When, why it's so interesting. If you're Jewish, do you look for a Jewish dream interpreter? The rabbis talk about this because they want that. Because in fact, that dream interpreter is going to try to interpret your dream in terms of scriptural references and things of that nature. I think it's likely that that's not the case, that you go to the dream interpreter who works. And that may cross what we have as kind of traditional religious boundaries. At the same time, if you're a dream interpreter and you want to make more of a living, you might, because you get a coin for this. You don't do this for free,
right.
Or meal or something. You would want to expand your customer base by not limiting yourself just to Christians. And we know a lot of this about dream interpretation, especially because both bishops and, Christian intellectuals and Jewish, the rabbis, and even in the imperial law, they yell at them a lot, dream interpreters. We know they're active.
Yeah.
And they can cause problems, because knowing the future, dream interpretation is often seen as a way to, you know, to get into the future, to know it. That can be politically very dicey.
Yeah. 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 I guess, right. I think that's like, it's politically dicey. It's also, tell me what you think about that. Like, I was thinking in kind of like the way, you know, people of all religious faiths now like will go to a psychic kind of because it's fun. Like I get the sense that like sometimes people go to dream interpreters because it was fun to like hear, like, I don't know, what does this thing mean? And then you can imagine, you know, like the religious leader being like, why did you go to this person instead of that person? And, you know, sometimes it's dangerous and it's going to cause a bad omen. And sometimes it's just like you're enjoying the wrong thing. I don't know if that sounds right to you, but
I'm not sure whether I would think it's fun. I think that there's, there's a real fear involved in this, because I think a lot of people thought too that once the dream is interpreted, that kind of activates the dream.
Sure.
Now that activation can actually be bad, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's a little bit of perhaps of dread sometimes when you went to a dream interpreter, and you have these manuals show that the same dream, and you know, we see this back actually even in the Bible, in the Genesis story of Potiphar Joseph and the interpreter, right? The same dream can have radically different meanings, good or bad. So I if you're hoping for a good interpretation, and we have a rabbinic story that makes fun of this, you give the dream interpreter more money and hope that, you know, that was going to activate something.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thank you. Okay. So, you know, people are maintaining relationships with the invisible in all kinds of ways. And you talk about how space really matters with this too. You told us a little bit about kind of synagogues and, you know, what happens when the Torah scroll comes out of it. But can you tell us about kind of these like shared religious buildings, like how, you know, one building turns it goes from, you know, a temple into a church or something like that? These buildings are being kind of swapped all the time. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's a fascinating progression. So often, you know, I mean, we have several examples of this that we could see clearly. A lot of times you cannot see it clearly, but you have some kind of natural feature in the landscape that makes it kind of religiously or spiritually significant. I just kind of draw back in for a second on that one, because that also is an important part of understanding holiness and time. You have an undifferentiated landscape, you have undifferentiated time, and there are certain moments or certain places that kind of that look special. It's a spring, it's a waterfall, or when we talk about time, it's maybe sunrise or a full moon. These visible markers. These visible markers become important for people well before late antiquity, and they become places of veneration, places where they thought there's more access to the divine, to the spiritual world. Over time, these places, these natural places, get built. And those buildings, let's say, may have been, one may be a Greek temple on top of one of these springs or by one of these springs. And over time, that Greek temple, let's say, two things might happen to it. One is that it's abandoned. It just falls into disuse. Or Christians come and they convert it to a church. And that conversion might be forceful, or maybe it's a friendly takeover. We don't know. There's a whole scholarly narrative how Christians came in and destroyed all the pagan temples and built churches on them. But the reality, we think now, it was much more complicated than that. And a lot of them had been abandoned before. So why would you build a church on top of a pagan temple? And the reason is because ultimately people thought that there was a kind of innate or attached holiness to this space that they wanted to continue, but just under a different guise. So I think that's a nice example of the way that this they share this landscape. They may, some people might come and they revalue it, they re-identify it. But it, nevertheless, it's probably still becomes a place where not just people, not just Christians who adhere to the new church come, but other people in the area might still come to that place too, because it is still, in fact, has this innate holiness.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of the moves that the book makes about, you know, like you look at how all these different, you know, temples, churches, synagogues have all these kind of similar sanctification processes, right? And you know, one way to talk about it is like, well, yeah, look, the Christians come in and they take over and they destroy the temples and then they have to sanctify it. And you're looking at it and saying, like, if all these different groups are like have kind of rituals that they do to make a building holy, it means this was happening a lot. And like, and people had some sense of like, yeah, we do need to change it, but also there is something special here. I wonder, could you
right. Or you just, you know, build this church down the street.
Yeah.
Across the way, right? That's the easiest thing to do.
Right.
You don't have to pay the demolition costs.
Yeah. But there's already like a hub here. So we might as well like stick with this area, right? Like, I don't know, church planters still do similar things. Like you go to where the people are, right? But what about cemeteries? Do cemeteries work a little differently?
I mean, not really in a way. Well, these are places of the spirits.
Mm.
So it was less a matter kind of the holiness, except when the people are holy, because the people are there, if there are holy people there, and this becomes, you know, a major issue, especially in Christian circles, but even in Jewish circles in which the dead generally are impure, you know, there you still came as part of your piety, as action to your family. You visit and you did certain kinds of things there to try to, you know, connect to those spirits.
Yeah. 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 So space ends up being like one way people divvy up the world. And like you said, time is too. Late Ancient people had all kinds of ways of keeping time. It can drive historians mad, the different kinds of calendars they had, 7-day weeks, 8-day weeks, all that kind of stuff. But, you talked about this kind of, shared project of building sacred time. And a big part of this involved having people try to celebrate holidays on the same day. There's, you know, big fights about the date of Easter or Passover, right? Can you tell us a little bit though about like how did people keep time? And I don't know, what is how they keep time help us understand about an enchanted world?
But I think time is often more locally kept than we think. So when you look at the natural world, right? The natural world has a particular way of keeping time. Mm-hmm. The female body has a particular way of keeping time. People, as they age, have a more linear way of keeping time. So there are all these different kind of indicators. If you're thinking about like the calendrical world, the lunar cycle especially, is a visible way of keeping time in a way that the solar cycle is not. Right. So I think that people get more attached in many ways to a lunar cycle. But as we all know, the lunar cycle can be slightly differently observed. You know, is it a full moon or almost a full moon? Well, today's it's all cloudy. I can't really see the full moon. I think it's there, but I'm not so sure. So you probably had some level of difference among different religious communities. I mean, even among, let's say, a community of Jews in one town, a community of Jews in another town, it's probably done on a communal level rather than on a, what we would call a national level or an individual level, right? So a community, you know, would go into an observance together. There is a lot of struggle to get control of that timing. And we see it, you know, I'm so fascinated every year with when Ramadan comes to watch like the Saudis control Ramadan, or they exert that control by putting out the official word about when it begins or when it ends. So a lot of people in antiquity were trying to do the same thing. And the rabbis have a very elaborate system that they discuss that probably was not faithful to the historical reality about how it is that the calendrical information was spread. But as you said, you know, when the identity issues come up and the Christian theologians are trying to figure out Easter and they're trying to not make it Passover or some want to make it Passover, right? They're struggling. But what about Christians on the ground? When are they actually observing Easter? In which communities are they doing this and how are they doing this? We have very little information on that, I think. But we do have attempts later on to kind of reconcile some of these calendars, as you pointed out.
Yeah. I mean, I just sometimes forget what a big deal it was to people, though, of like, I don't know, you know, like you're used to, I don't know, like Athanasius's letter about the dating of Easter or something like that. But then like all the way in like Bede's ecclesiastical history, like, every third story is about, you know, how this terrible person is keeping the wrong date of Easter. Like, it is just like, it's like one of these go-tos of like, you're not one of us if you're not doing the calendar this way. And like you said, like the thing that, you know, the more sophisticated historian should do is say like, yeah, if you're complaining about it this much, it's because nobody's doing it. Right. Like these were not settled matters, and probably because there just like wasn't really a way to settle the matter. Right. Like, you know, especially out in England. But anyway, just something that popped in my
Right. head. No, it's technologically very hard.
Yeah.
To keep people on the same calendrical page.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's fun to think through that, too. You know, we're kind of getting to the end here. Like, what do you hope people take from a kind of big book like this?
So I'm trying to I think the main arguments that I'm trying to push is get away from identity and to think more. Really, there are two things that I'm pushing, both as a historian, because I think that it opens up different avenues and different ways of thinking about the historical world that professionally we engage in, but also beyond that, you know, for our own world, is, you know, to think a little bit harder about, or to push more the story about what we share than about what divides us. And maybe that is me also responding to this particular moment in time in our own lives, political lives, and so on. You know, identities can be very dangerous as well as ways of creating community. So they are double-edged swords. So that's one point. And the other point is this point of enchantment. And I'm glad you talked about Taylor and Weber at the beginning, because, it's funny, Weber talks about disenchantment a lot. He hardly mentions enchantment. That's right. Just a side thing. You need enchantment to get to disenchantment, which is what he's really interested in. But this notion of rationalization, transactionalism, and I guess part of the reason that's on my mind a lot is that I'm a teacher, and in terms of my teaching and my relationship to my students, I would like it to not be as transactional as I think they sometimes see it, right? Where I give information, they give me work, I give them a grade. That's our relationship. This teaching is relational, and I think the relationality of not just teaching, but a lot of other things in life, that was particularly driven home to me during COVID, where, you know, you had less opportunity at that, where you were mediated by Zoom, which is takes something away from that energy, that human energy. So to think a little bit harder about what it might mean to live in a world in which we were more relational, not just with each other, but also with these forces that might be greater than us, whether or not we believe in gods or a particular religion or not. So all those things are kind of swirling around, I think, for me, and things that I hope that people walk away from the book with. Kind of a different way of not just seeing late antiquity, but our own lives and the possibilities that are in front of us.
Yeah. That's great. All right, last question. What are you working on next?
Happiness.
Oh.
So I've been teaching a class on happiness in the pursuit of the good life, where we look at positive psychology and religious and philosophical texts on happiness and the good life, and try to create some kind of productive discussion between them. And the class turns out to be very popular, and it's gotten me engaged in a particular kind of dialogue, set of texts that I find really fascinating. So I will probably be pursuing that alongside of a couple of grant projects I'm working on the application of AI to ancient texts. So these are two very different projects. Yeah. But we are using AI to reconstruct, especially citation networks in ancient and some modern texts as well.
Wow, that sounds great. It's been a real pleasure talking. Thank you for this. And I hope to hear more about that soon. Okay, take care.
Likewise, thank you for having me.
Some days self-care starts with Nature Made gummy vitamins, a deep breath, and a little encouragement.
Mom, I'm really nervous.
Me too, honey, but we've got this. Repeat after me. I'm going to have a good day.
I'm going to have a good day.
I choose joy no matter what comes my way.
I bring joy wherever I go.
Quality gummy vitamins from Nature Made, the number one pharmacist-recommended vitamin and supplement brand, based on a survey of pharmacists who recommend branded vitamins and supplements.